Blog Talk Radio.
Utama, first of philosophy. We'll be discussing that in detail in a few minutes. Our week began in Africa, where we enjoyed self-determination and freedom, which were rooted in our sovereignty. Peace, family. When the Uplifting Us radio program that airs Thursday evening from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Dare to Win is the place where we have sobering conversations about the economic climate and the comparison to global economic issues that will free us and once again is on the path. Has developed an exact methodology on how to build this global machinery and pass it forward to our children and future generations. If you'd like to join tonight's conversation, please call 9-477-9. Press the number 1 on your phone when you want to make a comment and ask a question. If you prefer to listen on your computer, go to www.assistingus.com. Scroll down to the bottom of the home page, click on the Dare to Win button, then click on Listen Live. You will then be on the Blog Talk Radio site. If you want to get reminded on Blog Talk Radio for upcoming Dare to Win programs, click on the follow button. ULU members, we have our own social media community. Please join if you have not already done so. There is a Dare to Win group, and we would like to have your feedback on past Dare to Win programs, as well as topic suggestions for future programs. I'm Cecilia, and joining me for this evening's conversation is Brother Austin. He is a member of Hulu. Peace, Brother Austin. How are you doing tonight?
Greetings, Sister Q. I am excellent. Glad to be with you. You are breaking up a little bit. I don't know if you can tell it on your end. I hope it smooths out as we go forward. But I'm doing excellent tonight and looking forward to our conversation.
Okay. Thank you for letting me know that. I am hearing some kind of noise in my phone, but I don't know what it's coming from. I thought it was somebody in the background somewhere, but okay. We'll go forward and see how it works out.
Okay.
So, Brother, what led you to tonight's topic?
Well, Sister Q, I'm glad you asked that. I've been thinking a lot about Ujamaa is first a philosophy, and how important that is to the building of an Ujamaa economy. In other words, in order to build anything, you must start with a blueprint. And that blueprint, in terms of organizing a society or a civilization, is your philosophy. Once that philosophy is clearly embedded in our psyche, and we have a very vivid picture of what it is that we intend to build, then the process of manifestation unfolds. In other words, we're able to move from the idea of an Ujamaa economy to the reality of an Ujamaa economy by having a grounded understanding of the philosophical basis of what it is that we're doing. And so oftentimes, because we live in America and we live in these structures that have a philosophy already embedded in them, it presupposes, or it treats as a presupposition, certain philosophical principles that most of us don't think about a lot, and I think that will become clear as we go through the discussion tonight. I've been watching the news, as I'm sure many of our listeners have, and the question that sprang into my mind is, do most of the human family want a future of endless war? The escalating human carnage in Ukraine is a chilling example of the capitalist future we are all in for unless we take economic and political control of the world, or certainly that portion of the world in which we live. Now, this sounds daunting. It almost sounds like reaching for the moon, yet it is very doable. It is certainly not as difficult nor as painful as allowing the status quo to continue. We must be crystal clear that the war raging in Eastern Europe is a struggle over which capitalist faction will exercise global hegemony. The capitalist oligarchs in Russia are in a deadly duel with the neoliberal capitalists of the NATO-aligned countries in Western Europe and the United States. Ultimately, they are fighting over who will control the natural resources and the wealth of the African continent. So as I'm watching the news, and I'd love for our viewers to call in and comment, and I'm seeing 4 million people who have become refugees fleeing their native country of Ukraine into Poland and other neighboring countries to escape the bombing of their homes and their apartments. I was listening to a radio broadcast earlier today, and they were saying that 90% of those refugees are women and children. And so here there's a battle going on between a small group of billionaires fighting over who's going to control the world, and they are so callous and so uncaring that they have no problem bombing civilian centers and killing thousands and tens of thousands of people to achieve their objectives. Now, we are told that, you know, war is just part of the human condition. You know, humans have been fighting wars since the beginning of time. That's not true. And certainly not on the scale that we are witnessing today, with the possibility of eventually escalating into some kind of nuclear exchange, which would spell the end of civilization for everybody. So here we are watching this play out in front of our eyes, but we also see at the same time that we cannot afford to be spectators on the sidelines, because the consequences eventually are going to affect larger and larger groups of people. And so it really is important to start thinking very clearly about how do we take control of our own reality, create something that offers us a different path, that offers us the possibility of peace and prosperity, that's not some kind of utopian fantasy, but can actually be materialized on the sidewalks where we live and where we're trying to raise our children and grandchildren. So it's an existential threat for sure. And it requires of us a very sober assessment of what it is that's taking place and what are the options that we have in our own hands to do something concrete about this. So the question comes to me, you know, so if that's the reality that we're facing, how do African people take control and construct a new reality? And as I was thinking about this, Sister Q, it struck me that the second step is to build an economy based on mutual respect and cooperation. And I'm very intentional about saying the second step, because the first step is to become very clear about the philosophy that must begin to guide how we think and move in the world. So let's talk for just a few minutes about the second step, and then we'll pivot and get to the crux of tonight's conversation, which is Ujamaa is first a philosophy.
Okay.
So I would invite the family, you know, fasten your seatbelts, and let's get ready to take this freedom ride together. We in Ulu define Ujamaa as family-centered economics or familyhood that creates an economy. We are shifting the paradigm of how we look at the world and how we think about how we think the world should be organized, or at least that part of it that we live in. Mm-hmm. Our research shows that a group-owned, family-centered economy is the only viable path forward for African people here in the United States, on the African continent, and throughout the diaspora. A group-owned economy, rather than an individually-owned economy, is the secret sauce in the Ulu formula. Just imagine if Kroger or your local grocery store was group owned by your community. In other words, mm-hmm. the workers in the store, the shoppers who are shopping in the store, the residents of the community in which this store is located, all together collectively own and operate that local grocery store. What a difference that would make. But instead, this necessary and vital business is owned by the 1%, a small number of individual shareholders of the population who make life and death decisions affecting us and never even consult with us for our input. if the profit margins at that particular grocery store fall below a certain predetermined level, they will close that store, even though it is making money. In other words, the store is productive. It's not going bankrupt. It's not losing money. It's actually turning a profit every month. But because it's not turning more profit, the decision can be made to close that unit. And we know that whenever those hub businesses close, shut down in our communities, it leaves a gaping hole. The business, usually because the space is a large space, it's hard to put another tenant in there. And it becomes an eyesore and a place for criminal activity to take place. And the community slowly begins to die because that particular business went bankrupt or they shut it down. Mm-hmm. In an Ujamaa economy, and this is important, Sister Q, the goal is maximum employment, not maximum profit.
Okay.
And that's a huge difference. In other words, the workers are paid a living wage, not a minimum wage. They enjoy autonomy as they have input into how the work they do is performed. They are their own bosses through their worker committees. And when the business yields a surplus, the workers earn a portion of this as well. They work in an atmosphere of respect and dignity and democracy as they get to vote on the policies and major decisions affecting the business. So that's key. Imagine that local grocery store having that kind of organization. I don't know what happens in places outside of Atlanta, but it became even more exaggerated during the COVID pandemic. We would go into Kroger, and some days there would only be one or two registers open, and the lines would be going all the way to the back of the store.
Right.
And they would say, well, you know, we can't get enough workers in here, and this is what we're stuck with. No, that's not true. Because you're paying less than a livable wage, the job is not attractive, and therefore you can't retain the workforce. But imagine if that store that has, let's just say it's got 10 register lanes, and people are offered a living wage, $18, $19, $20 an hour. They wouldn't have any trouble filling all of those 20 register lanes. You follow what I'm saying? But they don't keep that many lanes open because rather than pay for the labor of the workers, they put that money in the bottom line to boost up their profits. That's the difference between Ujamaa economy and the kind of capitalist economies that surround us. Many of our communities, go ahead.
I was going to say, and we're beginning to see more and more where the stores are doing away with men and women cashiers, coming with more self-checkout.
Exactly.
They don't want anybody to do what needs to be done.
Exactly. And so that the way, just a shift in terms of, well, what is the goal of this business? If we say the goal is maximum employment, then we staff all the registers, right? We make sure there are workers in every aisle to answer questions and direct customers to the product to keep the store clean. You know, you go into the restroom and it hasn't had any attention since the morning shift because everybody's on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things can be addressed by a simple shift in the focus. Well, if we want this store to have maximum employment, then we make sure that the store is run so that the service level is excellent. The customer doesn't want for anything. It will still make money. Right? It won't make as much money, but it will make money.
Right.
And the salaries that those people walk out of there with every week then means that there's more money in the community to circulate.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole community benefits because there's more money in circulation. And that's what operating a business cooperatively allows you to do. On top of that, then there are these monthly or quarterly meetings of the unit holders where they come together and there's a conversation on how is the store running? What do we need to do to make it better? What errors are you seeing that we need to correct? And everyone is a part of that conversation that chooses to go. At least the meeting is open. You follow what I'm saying?
Exactly.
You're being invited to offer your opinion on how the business is working. And so now the business becomes a community meeting space where everyone who is serviced by the business gets to make a suggestion or a contribution to how we can run an even better enterprise. And keep in mind that as the business becomes even more successful and the surplus increases, a portion of that surplus also now is available to underwrite or to fund African-centered schools or a local health facility so that people, you know, have a place to go to take care of their health needs. All of this enables us to organize the economics of our community in a way that we now are in control of what is happening rather than sitting on the sidelines as spectators grumbling about, dog, why they only got two registers open? You know, why there's no one in the aisle to help me when I have a question. So, in other words, we rather than complain, we now have put ourselves in the position to actually be in charge of these vital businesses that are necessary for our well-being. So, on that same point, let me just go ahead, sister.
We have someone with a hand up. So I'm going to open the mic for this, and then we will continue. Caller with the last four digits, 3440, please state your name, where you're calling from, and make your comment or ask your question. Thank you.
Yeah, greetings. This is Brother Sabaka calling from South Florida. Greetings to you, Sister Q, and Brother Auntie. You got a conversation that's dear to my heart, but let me play the devil's advocate for a moment to have some fun with you. If we assume that the capitalists, international capitalists' intent is to increase the production of robotics and AI and reduce the labor force, therefore alleviating the labor costs so that they can increase their profits, what role does ULU or any cooperative economic venture play in trying to sustain jobs for that portion of the population that the capitalists will be trying to eliminate? I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Thank you.
That's a great question, Brother Chewbacca. That ain't devil's advocate at all. That's exactly what's happening. here's one response to your question that I would offer to you and to our listeners. We have to think about how do we organize our communities. Now, granted that a number of people are going to be put out of work by automation. We know that. So it becomes even more imperative that we are able to offer employment and meaningful employment the people in our community. So, for example, we know that global warming is an issue. The IPCC, that, you know, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change just came out with updated assessment that, you know, we have less than 10 years to cut global, carbon emissions by 50%, or else face some really horrific outcomes. And so what that means then is that in the places where we are, that there's a need to perhaps go solar or to develop wind energy or other renewable forms of energy. Well, those are opportunities to put people to work, to retrofit buildings that may be drafty and energy inefficient. Ulu would operate a company that would have the task of putting solar panels on the roof and retrofitting windows and doing the kinds of work that mitigate the things that's going to drive global warming. Those are jobs. So that, and then those people who are displaced by increasing automation, Ulu operates a training center to take those displaced workers and give them the new skills that they can use in the new economies so that they remain productive and available for gainful employment. Right now, what we have is they're just going to be laid off. Maybe there will be some unemployment available. As crazy as these folks are, they'll probably even cut the unemployment benefit. We already saw that even during the tail end of the pandemic. So that we recognize that the existing political structure is, because they are bought and paid for by the ruling classes, they're not going to come forward with viable solutions to how we address the social disorganization in our communities, and that's a role that Ulu will have to play. So yes, Brother Shabaka, that's a trend that we've seen. It's going to only increase. But what it says to us then is that Ulu, as an organization, we have the opportunity to retrain those workers and to put them into gainful employment in meaningful employment in ways that the capitalist structure never intended to do. Why? Because in their scheme of things, people don't have any value. Whereas in our philosophy, every person is valuable. Every person is created in the image and the likeness of the Creator, and therefore has value. And as we maintain their ability to work and offer their gifts, that enables us to build a healthier community. The point being, I think, and I'll stop with this, is the system has rendered all of us disconnected and isolated from each other. So very few of us are in a place to say, well, this is the problem. These are some solutions that might work. Let's try this and see what happens. Those aren't the conversations we're having. Most of it is just, oh, wow, the crime is rising, unemployment is rising, it's terrible, what are we going to do? And that's kind of how we have been left. So the opportunity that as we think about operating our own economy, the first question we address is we can put our people to work in meaningful employment. And that's one of the features that Ulu will do and allows to happen going forward on a scale that meets the problem. Sister Q, did you want to add to that?
What I wanted to say is we could have a niche in within the market just because we have human people. You know, we have, when you walk in the store, it's not self-service. There's someone there to help. It's not a robot walking up and down the aisles to help you. There's a living, breathing man or woman there to talk to you. So I think if we keep it a living organism, not a robotic group. You know, that will draw people just in and of itself, I think.
You're absolutely right.
Yes, go ahead, and then I'll take the call.
Now, I was just going to say, I was listening to a broadcast. They were talking about the Amazon workers in Staten Island had successfully organized a union in their shop. And black workers are exhausting themselves organizing and trying to form unions at places like Amazon and Starbucks and Walmart and these other major chains. And that's important work. And I'm not. And yes, it needs to go forward because those workers are in those places, and they're being exploited in terrible ways. However, a cooperatively organized business can provide those same goods and services. In other words, Starbucks is providing coffee, but they're not the only ones that can run a chain of coffee shops, or Walmart's or Amazon's. There are. If we organize these businesses as cooperatives, we can provide the same goods and services in a way that is beneficial to the community and doesn't have people all stressed out. And the last point that I'll make, Sister Q, on that is simply that we're talking about, for example, if the Kroger was a cooperative. Our goal in Ulu is that every need that a community has, whether it's groceries, whether it's the dry cleaners, whether it's the drugstore, whether it's a food place, whatever the services that we need in our communities will be offered through a cooperative business model so that a Ulu member can spend all of their money inside of an Ulu business. They don't have to go to these other corporations and get ripped off. So it's not just one store. We're talking about arranging the economics in a way that we're meeting the needs for goods and services to the entire community. And we're doing this by vertically organizing. So, for example, if we're running the grocery store, well, we also in relationship with the local farmers, and the farmers are providing the produce, the value-added packaging. We're doing that. So the entire operation, when it's fully operational, is a cooperative from top to bottom. Then we begin to make a serious impact in how we're living.
I'm going to take this next call, Brother Ossie.
Greetings, family. This is Lee Malachi from Wake Forest, North Carolina.
Peace, brother. How are you?
I am wonderful. I am well. Greetings to you, Sister Q. Brother Octi, greetings to you.
Good to hear you, Brother Z. How you feeling?
Thank you. Thank you. I'm feeling pretty excited right now, especially after hearing my brother, Shabaka, ask his question. That is an extremely incredible, dynamic question. What kind of person comes up with a question like that? I was like, don't hurt him too bad. Don't hurt him too bad. So I would like to pull up alongside of Brother Shabaka with a question of my own. But before I do that, Brother Octi, I would like you to know that the things that you have been saying for the past 30 minutes in the beginning of the show regarding Ujamaa, its philosophy, it has been swimming around in my head. So when I think about us taking control of, economic control of the world, I can't help but wonder to what degree in the how.
I'm always thinking about that. And one of the things that's still swirling around in my head was when you were talking about how those billionaires were battling over control, just making a mess, you know, of the abode that people are raising families and doing things to contribute to the quality of their community. That's economics. So I can't help but think about that because I think it's going to tie into Ujamaa. And I also can't help but wonder, why isn't Ujamaa a prevailing way or for how we live? Is it because what we haven't done after experiencing attacks or war? So that's why that's lingering in my head about, you know, these billionaires battling it out and just destroying a whole bunch of stuff. Right? So my question, here's my question. Ujamaa, first being a philosophy or blueprint towards something we are interested in, does our interest go beyond the current era where we are forced to use a monetary system?
Okay. Excellent question. And I think your question is pointing us toward the more practical aspects of the Ujamaa economy, and you raise the critical question of how. And so let me just say that we've been saying in Ulu for a minute now, the key is to pool our dollars to generate the startup capital to start the businesses that we want. A Ulu co-op unit costs $1,000, right? Every 1,000 members purchasing a co-op unit equals $1 million. Do the math. 1 million co-op units purchased equals $1 billion. Once the pump is primed, the businesses can run on their own, or we can continue to pool our money and open new cooperative businesses. So the concept is very clear, and it works. It's a question of pooling the dollars to generate the capital to open and run the businesses initially. This is being done in other places. In other words, this is not something that we thunk up by ourselves and it doesn't exist anywhere. We've talked frequently to our listeners about the Mondragon Corporation in northern Spain. They started in 1956 with just six workers as a cooperative operated and owned and run by their workers. And in 20 years, they had pushed that operation to where it was doing what? 24 million annually? 24 billion annually? So it, in other words, we have to think in terms of Ujamaa as on a global scale. This is a multi-billion dollar mechanism. The wealth is sitting in our wallets and in our pocketbooks as we speak. And so the how of it is by pooling the resources that we have currently flowing through our fingers and opening our own businesses. The exciting thing about that, at least in my mind, Brother Z, is that this is the only path where we don't have to get anyone's permission. We don't have to go to the county commission and ask them to put in place legislation for us to do this. We don't have to call the Biden administration and ask them to for an executive order. We don't have to go down to Citibank or Wells Fargo or Chase and ask them for a loan. This is everything necessary to do this is already in our hands. It's just a question of will we pool our dollars? Will we draw upon the expertise and the genius that's already in our community? And will we run our own businesses cooperatively? And that's where the family-centered, group-owned becomes essential. In other words, there's a different dynamic in the way we operate our businesses. Again, Our goal is maximum employment. We are not doing the business for maximum profit. The businesses will yield a surplus because they are designed to do that. But our motive for doing this, for getting into business, is not to make a profit. That's the capitalist philosophy that drives how they do business. And so in the capitalist world, if something can't make maximum profit, they won't even do the business, even though it supplies a need in their community. We, on the other hand, are trying to get dollars into circulation in our community so that everybody has the resources that they need to buy food, clothing, and shelter. It's a very different approach and outlook on how do you organize a community's economy and politics. And as I said, this is something that is completely within our control. We don't have to ask anybody to do this. We decide, we do it, and everyone else has to react to what we're doing. Now, yes, as it becomes more and more obvious that this is going to be successful on a massive scale, there's going to be some people coming at us. But by that time, we will already have seen the power that we have in organizing our own economics. In other words, we're not dependent on politicians that are beholden to the ruling elements. It was tragic to see the Build Back Better program go down in flames because of one or two senators, Manchin and Sinema, who were bought out by the millionaires. And Manchin has his own fossil fuel built business, and he's not interested in seeing climate change addressed. And so all of that energy, a multi-trillion dollar initiative that could have had a tremendous impact across the country, was defeated by two people because of their own personal interest and greed. And so everyone that needed that is just standing in the lurch because now we have to wait for some other energy to come around to see if that can be revived. But in building an Ujamaa economy, we don't have to wait for anybody. We just have to talk to our sisters and brothers and say, you know, don't you think black folks should control the economics of our community? And if they say yes, we say, well, this is how we do this, right? You may not have $1,000 in your pocket right at the moment, but everyone can put themselves on a subscription plan where over time they can come up to their $1,000 purchase amount and buy a co-op unit. And then, as we said, for every 1,000 units sold, that's $1 million. For every million sold, that's $1 billion. And in every major city in the United States, the black population is well over a million. So it's not like we don't have the numbers and we don't have the money. We do. It's a question of organization. And so that's the how part of it, Brother Z. And then the other thing is that we will do this when we take ourselves seriously enough and value ourselves enough to say that this is how we're going to live. We're not going to be defined by other folks. They're not going to determine the future that I'm going to offer to my children or what I'm going to be able to provide for my family. That is within my hands and within my ability to do that. Now, the key is this has to be a group effort. We're not going to be able to do this Lone Ranger style, rugged individualism. That's not going to cut it. If we're willing to work together, to trust and respect each other, then this is more than doable. And one of the benefits from this is as this energy grows in the community and changes the way we see ourselves, all the negative stuff that's going on in our community begins to subside. The crime, the the black-on-black violence, all of that begins to become a thing of yesterday. Our communities look the way they look right now because there's no organizing principle operating in them that offers a future and a hope that people can participate in. And so this really is life and death for us. The good news, it's a gift from the ancestors. Marcus Garvey gave us this model back in 1920. And so we've seen it before. Now it's just a question of doing it. I'll pause there, Sister Q. There might be some other questions.
No, there's no one else. Brother Z, are you satisfied with your answer? Anything else you want to add?
I mean, Brother Ox, he was going in. I'm going to have to go back and listen to it again.
But
I appreciate that. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Appreciate you, Brother Z.
We have another caller, Brother Auntie. He's firing the folks up here tonight. Caller with the master digits, it's 1249. Please state your name, where you're calling from, make your comment, or ask your question. Thank you.
Yes, it's Brother Stubbs. I'm calling from Georgia. Every now and then I'll stick my head in here and see what the elders are speaking of, and just to kind of, you know, see how the Ulu Co-op is progressing. But what I was, I haven't heard, I was hoping one day to hear you all speak about what just happened in California here about a month ago. You know, of course, as they passed AB 3121, which is the first lineage base, which is the first past lineage base reparations. And, of course, and you know, most people, Generation X and younger, are very excited about that. And it all kind of plays into reparations. It all plays into cooperative economics, because I see cooperative economics as preparation for reparations. I'm a big champion of cooperative economics as well. And so, yeah, I just wanted to, you know, just come in before you all leave. Just first of all, so you all familiar with what happened in California. And, of course, just to get thoughts, just support things that I've heard so far.
Thank you.
I'm aware of that, brother, but that's not my strong suit. If Brother Shabaka is still on the line, he may have some information for us. Or if anyone else is on the call that has been watching that California development, please call in and chime in and share some information with us. Any other parts of that California initiative, brother, that stand out to you?
The fact that, you know, the fact that, you know, of course, this is, it's a, you know, of course, California, the, you know, big state, is not, you know, of course, Black America in California is starting to join the, you know, of course, a lot of us kind of getting priced out of California. California was bold enough and innovative enough to do it. It made it a serious issue. And of course, in part of this reparations movement compared to some of the older ones, it's really being politicized and weaponized to, you know, to demand tangibles, you know, for our people, especially those, you know, that were enslaved here in America, and of course that lived the cost of blackness and hadn't really been able to build wealth like we should, because we're over debt. We have to do things like cooperative economics and kind of hope for the best in those situations, you know, of course, and that's pretty much the best tool we got to community wealth building, getting more. Once, hopefully, and I say it with a lot of confidence that, you know, that we will eventually, you know, get what's owed to us, so we can, you know, of course, achieve the economic empowerment that was denied our our ancestors, you know, for so long. So, yes.
Well, I agree with you that a tremendous debt is owed. There's no question about that. That runs into the trillions. So on the question of reparations, this idea of repair, the first level of repair has to do with self-repair. And in other words, there's some things that we as a people have to do for ourselves. Baba Hekima often quotes our ancestor, Baba John Henry Clark, who says, freedom is something that you have to take with your own two hands or you don't have it at all. In other words, what's going to happen, you know, in my view, is that as we build Ulu, as we grow to a multi-billion and then a multi-trillion dollar economic enterprise on a global scale, the reparations piece is going to be a lot easier to navigate and negotiate. It's the whole reparations question is a question of power. So it is in our self-interest to develop our communities such that we have organized our people and our money in such a way that we've become self-sufficient. In other words, we paid our own reparations. Now, that's not to say that if some folks are feeling, have become aware of the history and of the injury that was caused by enslavement of our ancestors, and they want to address that, fine. However, building an Ujamaa economy puts us on a trajectory that really is self-determining in a way that one of the things that we've learned in doing this research around understanding economics, wealth is not in gold or diamonds or coltan. Wealth is a function of human activity, period. The diamond only has value because some people agree that it has value. The challenge that we face is how do we harness our own human energy in such a way that the value that we produce comes back to us first. The problem is we are producing wealth for other people via what they call a J-O-B. So we go to work 9 to 5, 8 to 4, whatever it is, and we inject or invest our labor, and they give us a portion of it back as a weekly salary. Now, in other words, we created $10,000 of labor, and they paid us $500 at the end of the week, and they put the $9,500 in their pocket. We'll never win that equation. We have to organize the work in such a way that that full $10,000 of value comes back to us. Yes. And then we figure out how we're going to distribute that in our own community.
Right. And I'm a person who's a part of a co-op, so I definitely know the dynamics and the concepts. So you would be preaching to the choir there. But what I want to ask you, there was a Black Cooperative Conference that was held last week up in Maryland that I had the chance to go to. Did your group know about that?
We were aware of the conference. I myself did not attend. There may have been some members in the Maryland area that were there that I don't know. What did you hear from that conference that stood out to you?
Well, I mean, it was just, I mean, of course, I attend, you know, conferences all the time where I get certain subject matter about, you know, especially pertaining to the work that my co-op is doing. But this particular conference is specifically a Black space for, you know, Black co-ops all over, you know, the country, and even some from from like the diaspora that were represented and present. And of course, it was just getting networking. I got a chance to make some strategic alliances and connections to aid, you know, of course, you know, to aid our work. And of course, and it was just good to see that there's a lot of young people that are starting to, you know, understand and embrace the concept of cooperative economics. And so, you know, cooperative economics only work, you know, when you utilize principle number six, which cooperative among cooperation among cooperatives, where you got a nation of cooperatives network and working and creating that cooperative economy. That's the model. That's the traditional model, and of course, and that model does work. And of course, and that's what you know a lot of that. That was one of the exciting pieces that I took away from it, is that, you know, the movement is starting to kind of resonate amongst the succeeding generations X and millennials and even Generation Z. So that was my takeaway. And of course, and I think they're planning another one toward the end of the year. So it may be worthwhile for, you know, of course, for you all to, you know, to go and just, you know, just to be in solidarity, you know, with the rest of the family.
Absolutely.
Doing the work. Yeah.
I agree. What you mentioned that you're a part of a cooperative. Which one is that?
Sorry. Oh, okay. You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hello?
I'm here.
Yes, okay. Yes.
Did you hear for the on-site question?
I said, well, you mentioned that you're part of a cooperative. What's the name of your cooperative? Raised an excellent point, Sister Q, and I'm looking at the clock. So let me jump to the heart of the matter, why I'm saying that Ujamaa is first a philosophy. And
okay.
That Ujamaa, as a family-centered, group-owned businesses, comes out of the African philosophy of Ma'at, truth, justice, righteousness, order, balance, harmony, and reciprocity. In Ma'at, there is an understanding that the physical comes out of the metaphysical. That's a fancy way of saying that in Ma'at, spirit is ultimate reality. In capitalism and socialism, material is ultimate reality. And this is critical, because even in cooperative circles, the underlying philosophy of the cooperative, even though it recognizes that people accomplish more by working together than by competing and by meeting their needs, they have not challenged the idea of materialism being ultimate reality. In Ma'at, because spirit is ultimate reality, and therefore each human being has value because they are created by that supreme energy, and therefore are both sacred and sovereign and divine beings, right? So when you start to operate at that level, you begin to realize that, for example, the planet, the land of the planet, cannot be owned and therefore cannot be sold.
Right.
It changes all of the ways that we think about reality. What's first? What's important? And so land can't be owned. That's a foreign concept in this understanding of Ma'at. Women are valued equally with men. There's no hierarchy in terms of the family structure. Again, that's a Western notion. So the problem, or I won't say the problem, the advantages that a Ma'at and a Ujamaa-based philosophy offer to African people is it helps us to realign ourselves with our own spiritual and social constructs. We're no longer operating on a European platform, so to speak. And that changes everything. So that's why, for example, we can say in our businesses, the goal is maximum employment and not maximum profit. Mm-hmm. We don't have to make an argument to take care of the environment because we recognize that Mother Earth is a living organism herself and therefore right. must be treated with respect and honor. I mean, these just go without being said. So uh-huh. the challenge, that's why when we are building this economic engine of an Ujamaa economy, we have to reorient all of our thinking because whenever we start handling dollar bills, we get pulled into a Western notion of what's important. And it's mm-hmm. hard for us to maintain the cosmic order of the universe and allowing us to make sure that we are serving the needs of people rather than replicating this materialistic, individualistic, competitive, violent, dominating over other people and dominating by white folks over people they classify as non-white, all of, and this willingness to go to war and destroy life and property. All of that mindset has to be overturned in our mind. Ezra right. Aharon, in his work Sovereign Psyche, says that sovereignty and this idea of divinity must first exist in the mind before it can exist on the sidewalk, before we can build an Ujamaa society. We have to first internalize that understanding mentally and become that mentally. And so that everything we think, say, and do is an expression of Ma'at and of Ujamaa. And it will mm-hmm. change the way we treat one another. It will change the way we treat Mother Earth. It'll change the way we handle the physical objects and resources and all of the products that are in nature have to be handled. That's why, for example, in African societies, if they were getting ready to cut down a tree to use it to make a drum, they first had to ask the tree, pray to the tree, and release the spirits and ask them, is it okay to use this tree to make a drum? You didn't just go in the woods and chop down a tree willy-nilly. Now, yeah. In modernity, that thinking would be considered primitive or superstitious or quaint or cute. But if you understand that tree is living and has intelligence just as you have life and intelligence, then you begin to honor life in all the places that life exists. That's what I meant by saying that Ujamaa is first a philosophy about life, how we understand the world and our place in the world, and our goal is to internalize that so that as we begin to harness the wealth that is in our community, we use it in a way that honors life and that is in alignment with the cosmic order of the universe. Only that will be a genuine expression of Ujamaa. If we don't do it that way, we'll call it Ujamaa, but we'll be doing capitalism, and that we don't need. So I realize we're over time, but I wanted to get that in and before. So I just want to say thank you, Sister Q, for allowing me this time to share. I certainly want to thank the callers who called in with their questions. I think we did good work tonight. I hope people got something from our sharing, and I just want to thank you again for guiding the discussion, Sister Q.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Brother Ansi, and we want to thank everyone that joined us this evening. Join us again next Thursday evening, 9:00 p.m. for another installment of Dare to Win. Peace.
Peace. Thank you.
Oh, no, I can't.